Sometimes it's better for me to just sit back, bite my tongue, and then in 4 years I'll be able to say what I want.
There has been a gradual institutionalization of this code of conduct, the effect of which is to prevent people from ventilating their views. Bright students won't put up with it.
Buckley Fellows believe that all perspectives must be heard and examined in good faith.
We stand united against the formation of a liberal-only echo chamber at Yale.
We disagree, we debate, and then at the end of the day, we remain friends.
For today's episode, I'm happy to welcome for the first time Jacob Tyler, a freshman from Bozeman, Montana.
Great to be here, Ari. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. And returning to the podcast, Isaac Oberman from Reedsburg, Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for joining us on Pod and Man at Yale. So I brought you guys here to talk about the culture here at Yale and who defines it. The culture in the Ivy League in particular is often dominated by students from the coast. They often like shape how people talk about things in like casual conversation in class. The two of you are not from the smallest of small towns, obviously. You know, you guys had electricity and normal functioning running water. But you guys, I guess, would be more from like a middle America, I guess, is how people would think of where you guys are from. Did you feel at all that the culture here was different from what you guys had at home?
I mean, one of the biggest things you can see is when people start talking about their summer plans, everybody's asking, where are you guys going, D.C., New York? And I'm like, maybe I'm going home to see my family. it's a crazy concept to prioritize family values in on Yale's campus. And it's always vocationally focused and everything is so fast paced and everybody talks about their job instead of what they want and what they actually value in life.
That's absolutely true. We also have a big boarding school presence here, so kind of the wealthy East Coast elite vibes a little more on campus, which is definitely different from where I'm from. You have people talking about issues, current economic issues, and they're just very disconnected from what society sees. I've had conversations with my suite, who a lot of them are from boarding schools or top prep schools from, Ari said, the coasts, and we're talking about stuff like inflation and they don't believe me when I say that inflation is bad right now, and it's kind of hilarious, but it's also sad because these are the future leaders of America, and it's a little worrying, the disconnect.
So you guys feel they're, I guess, a lot of the people who maybe come from that boarding school culture or come from the coasts, big cities, they're kind of out of touch with the lives that you grew up in, the culture you grew up in?
Oh, very much so. I mean, the urban environment is just so much faster. And I always use the word, I always characterize the difference between urban and rural as speed. At urban society, urban culture and life moves so quickly. There's always something going on. In rural society, there would be days I would just go home and I would sit in my backyard for the afternoon and just look up at the sun. just look in the sky, look at the clouds, just enjoy nature and not have anything to do. And being able to be just there in the world instead of having to have something to do. I do think the urban necessity to have something to do always really is harmful, actually. Yeah.
I also feel it's kind of a socioeconomic divide where at Yale, like I said, the East Coast elite are very, very present and overrepresented here versus obviously Montana, we don't have any East Coast elite.
So Isaac, he's from a relatively small town. I mean, it's not a one red light town.
There's about three. Yeah.
There's three. I was being charitable. The place is Reedsburg, Wisconsin, population about 10,000. Closest big city is Madison. It's about 60 miles away. Was there any culture shock when you first came to Yale?
Definitely having to interact with so many people in one day, taking the campus about 6,000. So my small town was about 10,000 people, had more people than our in campus. But then localizing the entirety of my small town within a mile radius of campus, I interact with a lot more people in my day. And so I become a lot more sociable now that I've been on campus. I used to be quite introverted. Having to interact with more people in my day to day life has, helped me to make stronger connections, make connections quicker, and just be better at networking and stuff such as that. Yes.
So, I mean, my city's not small. It's 50,000 people, but it's kind of not like Isaac, because I think Montana's a little different. You can't go to the next big city because we don't really exactly have that.
back in August 2022, the Associate Director of Undergraduate Admissions here at Yale said that Yale admits about 80 to 100 students from rural areas each year, about 5% of the freshmen in class. Jacob said, actually told me he was originally part of the rural students at Yale when he first got admitted. How do you think that kind of split divides the campus? I think I checked the census estimates, about 20% of the U.S. population lives in rural areas. It's 5% of Yale. How do you think that, I guess, discrepancy impacts the culture?
It might be not exactly representative of the entirety of America, but I don't know if the campus necessarily needs to be matching that split completely. I was a bit of a black sheep in my own town because I did like care about academics and such like that. So I would be out of water in my own town too.
I want to ask another question. This isn't really about the political bent of the campus, like although the two tie to each other, can be closely tied. But I want to focus more on the outlook of the students and even the administration. What are the kind of things that are and we talked a little bit about this before, what are the kind of things that are valued, in terms of social currency? Yeah, I've done this, experienced this, saw this, read this. What are the kind of things, or done this, right, or planning to do this? What are the kind of things that are valued on campus that would have been weird back in your hometown and vice versa?
I don't want to characterize it as a fully blue collar, white collar, or academic split, but sure. Many individuals back home are more worried about going to work and getting the food on the table and then relaxing than they are about necessarily reading philosophy and trying to understand more questions about what does it mean to live a good life and such like that.
That's very real. I'd never heard the name Nietzsche before I came to Yale, and it was better. I mean, my life was better for it, but but I've heard some takes here that are truly very, very strange. And back home, it's of course our life has a purpose. Everyone kind of has that kind of mindset. Yeah, all innocent life is valuable. I hear people and they don't believe that here. I'm that's kind of crazy, man. I don't really understand where you're coming from.
That's actually very true. In my hometown, we never asked questions because we just had an inherent head knowledge of it. Instead of having to think about why we believe these things, it was just we knew these things and we didn't have to question it. So I have actually enjoyed being able to put almost a thought process to my beliefs at Yale, but there is something that about having to think so heavily about it that and trying to think about why we believe these things that can oftentimes lead us away from our beliefs. And I wonder about that.
Was it intimidating when you first got to campus?
Yeah, I was intimidated because everyone has imposter syndrome when they first come. They're I shouldn't be here. Everyone else is so much smarter than me. And I'd hear these crazy takes from people and I'd be oh my gosh, I just don't understand it. Now I hear crazy takes from people and I'm what are you thinking, man? this is insane. Yeah.
So when I went undergrad, I didn't go here. I went to Johns Hopkins down in Baltimore. And I had a friend there who was from Texas. I don't even think she was from a rural area in particular, but her family was, I guess, not middle or upper class. And one of the things she mentioned, she told me a story that always stuck with me, that her family always ate fast food. And she had somehow emerged fairly healthy, but her family did not care about healthy eating at all. And she came to college and everyone cares about healthy eating and they dump on McDonald's and eating that too much. And she kind of said that it was a sign that it reminded her that she was a little bit of fish out of water, in that sense that she the vibe on campus was very different than kind of I guess her lower class upbringing. Does Yale have that kind of upper class vibe to it?
I mean, when you get salmon for lunch twice a week, it's a little different. I mean, I love the salmon. I'm never going to say no to the salmon, but we go into the dining hall. We have two different entrees, an entire salad bar, a grill open to us, pasta every evening, and just so many options and so much food. And the amount of waste I see is also really sad. I also see this a lot in clothes. Very interestingly, the wardrobe of individuals. There's always going to be your eccentric characters. The shoes too. But I'll be wearing my flannel. I'll be wearing a sweatshirt, just jeans, sweatshirts, jeans, standard school wear. That's just kind of standard in Wisconsin, at least. And there'll be kids coming down in full suits, and there'll be kids coming out in their sweater vests, and they wear a different sweater every single day, and it's all very, very nice, very, very beautiful clothing. But there's not necessarily a need to almost dress to that standard, the standard Ivy look, you know?
Right.
I don't know. I kind of like being different. I feel like it stands out a little bit.
Oh, for sure. I'm never going to stop wearing my flannels.
It's wild that you wear what normal people wear on an average day, and you guys are kind of standing out.
It's kind of crazy. I've never seen shoes like fancy shoes on a daily basis like that.
So I want to turn a little bit from your, I guess, from specific Yale questions to broader question. One of the Buckley speakers is actually showing up coming later today, Rob Henderson. He actually went to Yale himself, graduated in 2018. One of the things he talked about, he pioneered something called luxury beliefs. You guys ever heard of it? It's the idea that particularly progressives, tend to be white female progressives, have these ideas that like are terrible policies, but they all support them because that's kind of what the progressive movement says. And they can support those policies because they're insulated from any of the negative costs. Single motherhood is like a classic example where if you are wealthy, upper class, and you want to, you know, have a child on your own, you have the money, you have the family, you have the infrastructure to like protect yourself from all the negative externalities of like having trying to raise a kid on your own. But that's a terrible policy for a poor person, right, to raise children on their own, let alone one, let alone two, with like you're just going to be on food stamps your whole life. You're never going to get out of poverty. So I wonder, do you see this among your classmates or among your professors on campus where they have ideas and perspectives on policies? I think Jacob sort of referenced this before, that you kind of go like, that just seems like a terrible idea through and through. Like, where do you even get this from?
No, there are definitely a lot of individuals standing in their towers, looking out at their just at the world and being like, I'm up here. Life's good. I don't need to worry about what's down there. And then there are people down here who are looking up at the tower and being like, it's terrible down here. What are you doing? There's a fire in the dumpster over there. Like, can you please come down and help? Yeah. We're so disconnected in our bubble. There's a wealth bubble, too, that they don't see. Issues with like the real estate crisis that was happening earlier,
yes.
Where it was almost impossible to buy a home.
Because they're from New York City where the prices are normal to them.
So true. Or they can afford it. Like they can right. still afford it. It's our home, which was not worth more. Actually, I'm not going to put prices. Our home jumped in one and a half times its worth in like.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like
we don't even have a house. We rent because it's so expensive.
That's
We're waiting
crazy.
For it to calm down a little bit. But I also think like. Another thing that I've seen on campus, and I took a class that was very heavy on this, is like the idea of white privilege, where people are really, really hammering that idea. And like, it's really hard to convince people otherwise that maybe that's not a thing, because every single white person they know here is extremely privileged. And it's hard to like be like, no, there are white people who actually like don't have those same opportunities as you, other white person, or as this white person that you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting point. I guess I've never thought about it that way, that a lot of the people who are the most vocal proponents of like white privilege are surrounded by people who are white and are privileged.
100%, yes. Yeah.
So it kind of like warps their perspective on like what white people interact with and deal with on a regular day-to-day basis. Are there any like you think Ivy League campus specific like examples of that, like things that like they want people believe we should be doing on campus, or like all students should be doing on campus, that are like, you know, like totally insane, not like general policy perspective, like the way they live their lives on a day-to-day basis, or the way they expect people to live their lives on a day-to-day basis that like back at home just would seem totally crazy.
Ooh, I got a good one. All electric.
Yes.
It's cold in Montana and electric engines don't run that great when it gets to negative 40. And so like I love Teslas, and I actually gave a speech in the party about this. I love Teslas so much. Like in Vegas, when people drive Teslas, I was like, that's awesome. I see people in Teslas with Montana, like in Montana, and my friends are like, what an idiot. Like literally, because like their car is going to break down on them in winter if they actually live here. And it's also difficult. Like we don't have charging stations there, man. Like you can't really own a Tesla there. It's really difficult. So when people are saying like, oh, we need to go all electric, we have the infrastructure. Like, no, we do not. Maybe where you're from, like you can go all electric. My state can't ever. It's not going to be a thing.
Energy is a great one. Maybe like agricultural practices and food is something that I always say, like individuals are very worried about like going meatless, or like because the environmental aspects, like the climate aspects of meat and meat, the meat production, like all how meat production like forwards the climate change problem and global warming. And like coming from Wisconsin, where like cows make up like over half of our state's GDP, definitely not real true, but like it's close enough. Having just like such vitriol and like such hate towards meat and consumption, and like towards like the main like what really like forwards my entire state's like economy, it's not practical. It's not practical to say no, we can't eat cows. Like we need to eat the cows because my family needs to eat too. So I think some of those the ideas about like what we consume are also very different.
Go ahead. No.
Sorry. People also don't understand that like consuming meat can actually be good for like the ecosystem, because like most people think of it in a factory farming way, which granted, like that's fair. Like that's all they know. But like when you actually hunt, like there's a reason that we're apex predators. Like Back in Yellowstone. Like, like in Yellowstone. In Yellowstone, when they took the wolves out.
That's the best sentence I've heard in a really long time.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty dumb music. Yeah. Right. But like in Yellowstone, they killed all the wolves because they were eating farmers' like livestock. And it was horrible for the entire ecosystem in Yellowstone. So like if we're going to say like, oh, we shouldn't kill animals, like we are an apex predator similar to wolves. And like if you remove an apex predator from an ecosystem, it is not good. Like they're keystone species generally. So like it can cause a whole lot of problems.
So one last question, just kind of wrap it up. What do you guys do? We like touched on this in various points. What do you guys do to feel like more comfortable and less out of place here at Yale?
Well, I think the best way is to find communities that share your values.
When I'm at Yale, I'm grinding. Like this is my workplace. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to just work as hard as I can. And then when I go home, I'm going to do things that I enjoy.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for joining us, guys. I'm Podman at Yale.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Keep Yale out of politics and focused on education. Sign our petition today calling on Yale to adopt institutional neutrality. Truth should be Yale's mission, not commenting on every political controversy of the day. Sign the petition at fightforyale.com/institutionalneutrality.
Now, with that, let's get right to our interview with author and Yale alum Rob Henderson, who spoke for Buckley on Thursday, April 11th. Check out our YouTube for the video and check out our website for more details. It's my pleasure to welcome to Pod and Man at Yale, Rob Henderson, not only a Yale alum, but a Buckley Institute alumnus also. He's best known for pioneering the concept of luxury beliefs, which we'll go into later. He recently published his first book called Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class, which has become a national bestseller. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy if they haven't already. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ari. Great to be here.
So first I want to ask you about your book, you know, which is a memoir. You had a very challenging childhood, to put it mildly. I saw some of the stories, like they're heart-wrenching for me personally.
Yeah, I just wanted this book to communicate my life experiences as well as those of my friends. You know, I didn't want Trouble to just be that kind of conventional bootstraps narrative of, oh, this, you know, hard scrabble life and you just work really hard and everything gets better. I also dwell on some of the stories of my friends that I grew up with and how their lives turned out, because I wanted the reader to understand that, you know, my life, you know, obviously is kind of extremely anomalous statistically, right? You can't necessarily expect a kid the way that I grew up to end up where I am. So I wanted the reader to understand the kind of modal outcome, the expected outcome of a young kid, a young guy who grew up the way that I did. And so, you know, of my five friends who I grew up with, my five close friends, we were in this, you know, this tight-knit group. And of the five friends I had, two of them went to prison.
Wow.
I had one friend who was shot to death.
Oh my God.
And, you know, the other friends, you know, they're in kind of varying states of like menial work or kind of working jobs that they're not particularly happy with. I have friends who, you know, they have multiple children with multiple women they never talk to. And, you know, this is a very sort of common picture of what life is like in so many parts of the country.
So how did you kind of, I guess, get out of that? I know you said you enlisted in the military, but you also, you know, had to make a conscious decision that like this isn't something I wanted. It's like it sounded like a lot of people in your situation, you know, a lot of kids in your situation, you know, how many teenagers have that presence of mind to make those decisions? But how did you kind of come to that decision to want better?
So one of the things I try to communicate in the book is that the importance of male role models and kind of mentors, especially for, you know, young guys who grew up in fatherless homes the way that I did. I grew up never knowing my father. I tell the story in my book about how I had an adoptive father for a little while, but then I also lost contact with him. And so I grew up without dad. Most of my friends grew up without fathers. Once I left home and was in a good environment that was predictable and was stable, that finally allowed me to realize, oh, I want to go to college. I want to become educated. I want to, you know, get a degree and do well in my life and achieve some upward mobility.
What kind of role models do you think, you know, kids who are in broken homes or from foster care really would respond to?
One thing that I did when I was a student at Yale as an undergrad, I tutored at New Haven Reads. And there's kind of a self-selection. There's like a filter mechanism where the kids who go there, they have parents who really want their kids to learn and do well. And, you know, a lot of the kids that I tutored there also came from, you know, kind of impoverished backgrounds, disadvantaged backgrounds, fatherless homes and so on. And even then, a lot of those kids weren't always the most sort of focused, but I think they appreciated having one or two hours out of their week just with someone who they could talk to, even if we weren't necessarily focused on literacy or reading or skills. Sometimes we would just talk, you know, what did you do at school today? Right. Or, what, you know, what are your favorite snacks? What do you like to do? What TV shows are you watching? And it's just like they're there for one or two hours with an adult who takes an interest in them. And that alone, I think, even if it doesn't have some kind of long-term measurable effect in their life, I think just having an adult who they feel comfortable with, who they can talk to, is good in itself, regardless of whatever sort of influence they may, that might have in their future grades or something.
So what are the kind of things, you know, outside of male role models, you know, for, I guess, for kids who need it, what are the kind of things that, you know, increase the likelihood of success? I mean, some of it is like, sounds like a little bit of luck that you stumbled into the right people at the right time that said the right things at the right time. Mm-hmm. What are the kind of things that, you know, it help other children in foster care, difficult family situations get out?
Yeah. I mean, one of the points I try to make in the book is that ultimately we just want fewer kids in foster care in the first place, mm-hmm. because it's such an extremely chaotic and disorderly environment. You know, I'd go to a new home and befriend one of the foster kids or maybe a group of them, but then the next day one of them would be taken to another home. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's like I didn't know where my foster siblings were going to be. So what can we do? I mean, one of the, you know, and maybe this kind of segues into the luxury beliefs idea, which is, yes, there are, to some extent, there can be financial solutions. You know, I'm not opposed to government assistance. I don't, you know, I think, you know, I grew up poor. I can say that having money is better than not having it. But there are limits to money in itself. Like, you can't just give people money and expect them to make good choices with it. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of a myth among a lot of elites, is that, oh, if you just give everyone, you know, cut a check to someone, they'll just like naturally become a, you know, upwardly mobile and be able to achieve all the things that any of us want.
So I do want to talk now about luxury beliefs. Can you just kind of walk us through and then what luxury beliefs are and how you see them, and then we'll, you know, talk a little bit more about it.
So luxury beliefs are ideas and opinions that confer status on the upper class while inflicting costs on the lower classes. And a core feature of a luxury belief is that the believer is sheltered from the consequences of his or her belief. If you go back to Thorsten Veblen, 1899, he was an economist and sociologist who wrote this book, The Theory of the Leisure Class. And at that time, the elites in society exhibited their status through material goods. Today, goods are a noisier signal of status. So 100 plus years ago, it was very obvious just from looking at someone, you could know whether they were rich or poor. And today it's less true. You know, if you fast forward to the mid 20th century, there was a sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu. He coined this term cultural capital. And his idea was that people would exhibit their status through their habits, their opinions, their mannerisms, intricate and expensive hobbies and tastes. And so my claim is that today luxury beliefs are the latest manifestation of cultural capital. If you say things like, you know, defund the police or decriminalize hard drugs, or, you know, promote the idea that, being married is unimportant for mm-hmm. the well-being of families and kids, all of these kinds of things. You know, if you, and I go through the statistics and the survey data in the book, like on all of these measures, the more educated and affluent you are, the more likely you are to support those things. The more likely you are to say we should defund the police, the more likely you are to say that we should decriminalize hard drugs, the more likely you are to agree that, you know, having two married parents is unimportant for kids. And ultimately, they have detrimental consequences for the rest of society once these beliefs and ideas are implemented into culture and policy. The defund the police one is like the easiest example right. here, where in 2020, this movement gained a lot of influence. And a lot of cities did defund the police or reduce resources and spending, and they cultivated an attitude of suspicion around law enforcement. So a lot of police officers retired early. A lot of police, they're having difficulty with recruitment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a result, violent crime skyrocketed, and the people who were the most likely to be victims of crime, the targets of criminal offenders, are poor people. If you just look at Democrats, white Democrats were the most supportive of defunding the police, and Black and Hispanic Democrats were the least supportive.
Is from your perspective, is this all performative? Is it really just a signal like I went to a high, you know, I went to an upper tier university, I make a lot of money, I'm educated, like, but they don't really believe these things? Or do they actually believe these things? They're just so insulated from the consequences, they don't realize what's going on.
I almost don't think it matters very much because the outcome is the same. However, you know, my personal view is that most people hold them, who hold them are kind of innocent in the sense that they don't know the harm it's going to cause. But one point I make in the book is that if you are a graduate of an elite university and if you, you know, belong to this, very privileged segment of society, you have a duty to give your beliefs and policy proposals and ideas a very thorough analysis before you start promoting them.
Sure. One other thing I want to talk about, because there are a lot of different aspects to this, and you know, I've seen a lot of discussion on social media, you know, op-ed pages by you and others about this concept of luxury beliefs. And one, like, I guess, split off version I've seen is like the luxury beliefs that are intended to really kind of dispel competition in a sense, where people share luxury beliefs because they want other people to hold those beliefs and do those things, leaving avenues for them. Like, I guess an example that comes to mind is like students in law schools who say like, oh yeah, don't go into corporate law or don't go into consulting, don't go to Wall Street. That's terrible. But like really what they want or the subconsciously is like that fewer people apply to those things. And so the positions are available for them.
I don't think – no, come on. Law students aren't that Machiavellian, are they? No. Well, I don't know if I would consider that a luxury belief, because that's like – that's intra-elite competition. That's elites sniping at other elites, which is an important phenomenon, I think. Like Peter Turchin and other scholars and researchers have discussed this, and I think it's fascinating. But I don't know if I call that a luxury belief, but I do think that that does happen. That does occur. Like when I was a student at Yale, I would see people express this idea that investment banks are these emblems of capitalist oppression, and you know that they invest in fossil fuels and XYZ and all this stuff. And then you would see those same people at recruitment sessions for Goldman Sachs. Like they would, and I couldn't help but wonder, like, is this because they're trying to undermine the competition and attempt to eliminate their rivals? I mean, it's very cutthroat. Like the higher you go, I mean, this is another aspect of the luxury beliefs idea, because some people will ask me, you know, is it true? Do elites really care that much about status? Like, does that really something that people really focus on so much? And I report results from two different studies in the book. So this is a replicated finding in psychology that the more income and wealth and education people have, the more likely they are to say that they desire status. They're more likely to agree with statements like, it would please me to be in a position of power over others. They're more likely they are to agree with statements like, I enjoy when people look at me when I walk into a room, right? Like the higher up you go on the socioeconomic ladder, the more people agree with those statements, the more they like status. And so, this is like why I think when I first got to Yale as a student almost a decade ago, I was shocked because I was coming to Yale from the position of, wow, like I had to work and struggle so hard to get here. And now I'm like, I'm at Yale. Like my life is made. Like I don't have to worry about things anymore. And yet all around me, I'd never seen so much status anxiety in my life of students who were stressed out about getting the right internships, getting into the right law school, the right medical school, just sort of, it's always the next milestone. And in my mind, I thought I'd made it, but in their mind, they were just getting started.
How has the idea of luxury beliefs kind of distorted our politics?
Yeah, you know, most people, it's so funny. Like most people don't even know that the vast majority of American adults don't have bachelor's degrees.
Yeah.
Something like 60 to 65% of American adults don't have a bachelor's degree. They clock in, they clock out. They don't have professions. They have jobs. They're just trying to take care of their family, trying to make ends meet. And I think elites in both political parties, really, they focus on these weird boutique issues, not the kind of bread and butter, everyday economic issues and social issues that ordinary people care about. And, you know, this is, I think, what happens when you spend your entire life around other college educated people. You get stuck in, you know, I know there's this term echo chamber with regard to politics, but I think there's an echo chamber with regard to education as well, where you're only spending time around other sort of white collar, educated people, and you all sort of read the same news sources and have the same concerns and kind of lose touch with reality. You know, I when I was a student here, I took a couple of classes with John Gaddis, the historian.
Sure.
And he liked to say that common sense is like air. The higher you go, the thinner it gets. And I think there's something to that where, you know, if you've never really had to worry about paying your bills, or you've never had to worry about losing your job, or you've never, you know, had to, you know, worry about, you know, taking care of your kids and keeping your family together and those kinds of things, you know, suddenly you get caught up in like weird movements and ideas and policy proposals, that just become very disconnected. I'll make this one last point is that for a lot of, I'll just say the word elites, that their only exposure to poverty is kind of like the most apparent and visible and kind of provocative, parts of poverty. So, you know, they'll see people who are on drugs in the street, or they'll see, criminal offenders being arrested, or, and so on and so forth. But they don't have a lot of exposure to, you know, like they don't necessarily see people who, clock into their job to make a minimum wage, living, and then go home and try to pay their bills and take care of their kids. Like, that is not something that they think that much about. When they think of poverty, they just think of these very sort of, you know, visible examples that the media covers, or maybe things that they watch on TV, or things that they hear about on social media. But, you know, they're not, like, that's not the typical poor person isn't homeless. The typical poor person isn't a criminal. The typical poor person isn't, you know, they're like, they just have like a very sort of distorted view of what sort of poor and working class people's everyday lives look like, that the vast majority of poor people, are never arrested. They never commit crimes. They're just, you know, trying to keep their lives afloat.
So that's my last question. How does it affect the campus luxury beliefs?
Elite universities are, I think they're special places, and I'm not opposed to academia or anything like that by any means. But I do think that people who attend them, people who teach at them, who are affiliated with them should, you know, like, what is your aim? Like, is your aim to help people? Is your aim to look interesting and sophisticated? Is your aim to get more papers published? Or, I mean, what are you trying to do? And a lot of people at elite universities claim to want to help the poor and the marginalized and the dispossessed. And it's funny because this has been an aim of elite universities for decades now.
Right.
And then you look at actual poor and marginalized and dispossessed people, and are their lives actually improving as a result of whatever the intellectuals at the elite universities are doing? I don't really see that.
Well, I appreciate you coming on Pod and Man at Yale, and I look forward to hearing your discussion later today.
Great. Thank you, Ari.
Well, that wraps up another great episode of Pod and Man at Yale. Subscribe now if you haven't already, and always remember, for God, for country, and for Yale, in that order.